Welcome to Season 2 of the Let's Check In podcast, a place where cultural icons and frontline experts share how they navigate life's wobblier seasons. I'm your host, Susie McAvale. Let's check in.
Do you ever wonder how our past experiences shape our present moments and relationships? It's easy to feel overwhelmed by these challenges, but today we're here to shed some light on them. I'm thrilled to introduce Helen Nistico, a seasoned clinical psychologist with 25 years of experience in both public psychiatry and private practice. Specialising in complex mental health issues and personality disorders, Helen was instrumental in establishing the HYPE Clinic at Origin Youth Health and bringing cognitive analytic therapy to Australia. Helen is specialised in the treatment of adolescents with borderline personality disorder and has a particular interest in complex trauma. Helen, it's a real treat to have you here today on the Let's Check In podcast.
Thank you, Susie.
I'm so interested. What is it that keeps you in the area of mental health?
Firstly, psychology is such an interesting science. We're just learning all the time. There's so much to learn about our human nature. But I think too, we're constantly advancing in understanding our brain and understanding how we work. And our brain and our mind are so complex, it's really quite extraordinary. And if we think about how in our brain we've got this bunch of neurons that fire, right? And that firing we experience subjectively is pretty baffling. And so, look, the complexity of understanding how our brain and our mind works and how it also doesn't work so well keeps us, I think, fresh because we're always learning. I've really enjoyed the explosion we've had in neuroscience in the last maybe 15 years or so because we've got much better imaging techniques now. We've got PET scans and MRI scans, so we can actually look at what's happening in someone's brain when they're doing well or in different disorders, for example. So we're getting so much more information about how mental illness works from a neuroscience point of view, which means we're starting to have new ways of thinking about treating it, which is really, look, probably a little bit relieving actually, because sometimes mental health disorders are really difficult to treat. And I think it's really important that we keep getting better and better at it. One of the areas of neuroscience that I find really interesting is what we refer to as neurobiology of attachment. That area of neuroscience tells us how our brain is shaped for social engagement. Our brain is actually a social and emotional brain, amongst lots of other things. But that's important because our genetic tendency for social and emotional engagement and attachment is kind of influenced by the relationships that we have early in our lives and the relationships even now. That's really important for us to understand that we're actually social and emotional creatures. We're connected to each other and our nervous systems are connected to each other too.
So Helen, you were part of the initial development of the HYPE Clinic, which was focused on personality disorders in young people. And you were also part of a small pioneering group that established cognitive analytic therapy, or CAT, in Australia. You referenced that before. Can you tell us a little bit about that and what is CAT therapy and really how does it benefit people?
Yeah, sure. The HYPE Clinic is a specialist clinic within a broader service called Origin Youth Health, which is actually a leading clinical and research service in mental health in young people in Australia. So Origin Youth Health researchers provide specialist mental health treatment for young people. Their catchment is the west and the northwest region of Melbourne. And so the HYPE Clinic, I was part of the early development of it. It was established in 1999, so it's been going for quite a while. By Professor Andrew Channon in conjunction with Dr. Louise McCutcheon at the time. And another clinical psychologist, Dominic Germano, and myself made up the team of four that spent a few years developing, working together at the start of this HYPE Clinic. The HYPE Clinic stands for Helping Young People Early, which is just a name of a clinic, but this clinic is thriving today and specialises in working with young people with borderline personality difficulties. And it's a youth focus, so it's up to the age of 24. But it's an important disorder to treat the best we can and to look for helpful treatments for it. It's a disorder that has a really big impact on the sufferer and on the people supporting and caring for those people. borderline personality disorder. It's the third most costly mental health disorder in Australia. And really sadly, it has a really high suicide rate. So 8 to 10% of people with BPD take their lives. So it's really important. And the focus of Origin and of HYPE is on early intervention and trying to intervene early enough so that we can even change the trajectory of some people's lives in developing or not going on to develop this disorder. So at the start of this clinic, Professor Andrew Channon was looking for a treatment. It was his research. And he came upon cognitive analytic therapy and decided this was a useful treatment to trial in this group because CAT, for short, is a complex mental health treatment and this is a complex disorder. But also CAT is an interpersonal therapy, which means it's a therapy that focuses on relationships. And this is one of the biggest issues that people with BPD have difficulty with. So we did a 5-year research trial using CAT in this group of young people, but CAT hadn't been done in Australia before. It was mostly being done in the United Kingdom.
Why was it not in Australia at that point?
Just hadn't travelled here yet.
Sure.
So CAT was developed in the 1980s and then some other people contributed to its sort of theory, if you like, and practice through the 90s. And so this was the late 90s that Andrew and Louise were looking to bring CAT here. So it hadn't been around for that long. If you think it's not a long time really in the sort of development of a therapy. And it's since, it's got quite a good foothold through Europe and in Australia and New Zealand. Lots of people have done lots of work in Australia and New Zealand to get it going. And there's sort of smatterings of it in some other countries.
So what was it about CAT that spoke to you that you thought maybe perhaps other therapies weren't doing?
The research that I'd looked into in BPD is that actually when you look at psychotherapy research for most disorders, different therapies don't necessarily stand out. What we find is that the common factor in what actually helps people get better is actually the therapeutic relationship. All of us that use CAT love CAT. Once you come to CAT, CAT becomes your way of thinking or being in the world because it has such a helpful comprehensive theory, if you like. So CAT is both a framework for thinking about patterns of relating to others and to ourselves, and it's also a therapy, and it has a really helpful theoretical basis to it that helps us think about relationships and apply them to ourselves. So it's a really useful therapy for people who have difficulties in their relationships, which is why I think CAT is really suited to this group that we're working with. But I use CAT across all disorders.
Before you go on to that, I think it would be great to gain an understanding of what is borderline personality disorder?
Yeah, there's still a lot of misconception around it. Lots of misunderstanding. Borderline personality disorder is characterized by people having lots of instability in their emotions. So they might find that their emotions change really rapidly, or they might get really angry over and above what we might get angry. They have instability in their relationships and they have a sort of an instability in their sense of self, if that makes sense. These difficulties are sort of part of how their usual way of being in the world, which is why we refer to it as personality. It's kind of there all the time and it really impacts their functioning, especially socially and emotionally.
That would, I imagine, be quite difficult to even diagnose, particularly as you mentioned that you're working so much with adolescents. Mm. It's already a tumultuous time of development and varying emotions that people go through. I would assume it'd be very difficult in a lot of situations to actually even diagnose.
I think that's fair. I think that's right. And I also say a word of caution not to go diagnosing ourselves because, you know, we all have some levels of instability in our emotions and our relationships. That's normal. This is more of an extreme form of that, of what we might go through.
In your role as a clinician, you're dealing with so many different people each day. How are people grappling with uncertainty in today's technologically driven, fast-paced world?
I could answer that personally and clinically. I just feel like the world's pace is just crazy. I think that it's fair to say we're not coping very well at all. If you look at some of the mental health statistics, we know from Australian reports that sort of in the last few years, if you take a 12-month period of time, 20% of Australians have a diagnosable mental health disorder in any given 12 months. That's 20% of the general population. In young people, that is 40%.
Wow.
And it gets worse because in girls, if you take a 12-month period over recent years, in young girls up to the age of 24, that's a 50% rate of young girls in our country have a diagnosable mental health illness. That's one in two. I think that is incredibly alarming. We've seen a huge surge. We've seen a 50% increase in youth mental health rates in the last decade or so. Since 2010, they've absolutely surged. And we've got data that mental health is on the decline in our general population. We've seen an 11% increase in mental health disorders in the decade before the pandemic and a 50% increase in young people. So I don't know if that answers your question, but I don't think we're doing very well at all. And there was a really important commission report released a month or two ago, which, look, I was really proud of actually all the publishers. They were some of the leading mental health professionals in Australia and researchers, and they were really raising the alarm. So I think there's lots of factors that mean that we're not doing too well.
Yeah. So what are those factors that are really contributing?
Such a complex question, Susie. Maybe I could express it in two ways. I feel like there's external factors and then there's internal factors. And maybe the external factors are things that we're all aware of: climate change, cost of living, cost of housing, the constant barrage of media hyping us up, the scheduling in our lives, all that sort of extraneous stuff. But I feel like there's a lot of internal uncertainty, the way our culture shapes, like our sense of self, for example. So I feel like maybe we live in a culture that really values our external selves. So we get lots of messages about who we should be and what we should do and what we should look like.
Sure.
And for me, what that does is it has us out of touch with our sort of human nature, if you like, and our human needs. So it means that our sense of ourself perhaps isn't as based on our real selves, which I think when we feel like we can be our real self in the world, we have a better sense of certainty as well. So I feel like there's lots of internal uncertainties that we, or that our culture kind of generates on the inside.
Those statistics are really quite alarming, aren't they? I can see why you're really challenged by that and motivated in your work. What does the everyday person who has a young person in their life do to help when we know these things?
It's a great question, Susie. And I know clients come and see a psychologist and they have this idea that we've got the answers. We do have specialist training and experience, but I think it's a really good question that we ought to all be asking each other and ourselves, and to be open-minded about not knowing, because I think when we are able to be curious about things and not know is when we're really open. I think that we all need to find the answers together. I'm not sure that I have the answers, but I can certainly tell you my view.
Sure.
But I think it's really important for listeners and for everyone to feel empowered, to be able to feel like they can think in an open way and come to some of those answers, because actually feeling empowered as parents is really important. But I think some of the things we can do, I think we can slow down and get connected. Slowing ourselves down enough to sit and listen, being in touch with our bodies is really helpful. Our bodies tell us when we're hungry or tired, or if we've had enough of something we're doing, and we're kind of used to overlooking that signal as parents or overlooking those parts of our children. And I think the more we tune into ourselves, the more we can respond and identify what it is that we need and problem solve how do we meet our needs a little bit better. And to me, that's really central to certainty. If we can meet our internal needs a bit better in the outside world, then we're shoring up an important part of certainty for us.
Establishing that sense of self-regulation, I suppose, starting with the classic, put your oxygen mask on before you help anybody else.
Absolutely. Feeling allowed to look after ourselves, or even valuing looking after ourselves rather than looking after all the external pressures and standards.
That can be difficult for people, can't it, to stand up against the masses and kind of go with what is really for the day important. I think that's something interesting that a lot of people after COVID did experience. When it boiled down to it, all the external things really got washed away and we really had to look at the most fundamental important things to us. And I know that you more than anyone are going to understand the complexities and the challenges and the spikes in numbers that went up due to COVID and that whole colossal experience. But I think it's an interesting study, if you like, of human experience around how we all cope when we're under extreme stress too.
It was kind of a parallel experience, wasn't it? Because on the one hand, we slowed down because everything was closed. And so maybe we did sit in our garden some more and, I don't know, make pastry that we'd never made or something that we'd always wanted to do. And on the other hand, there was so much uncertainty and so many other unexpected pressures and stresses.
Absolutely. If I can just change channels to heritage and family stories here. Your mother's family were from a wealthy Czech Jewish family who were persecuted in the Holocaust, and your grandfather was actually in Auschwitz for 5 years. Tragically, you lost your mum at the age of 10 from Hodgkin's lymphoma. How has your, and I guess your family's trauma, really influenced your lens towards life?
Yeah, my mother and her family are from the Czech Republic and my father's Italian. And both of my parents grew up in the aftermath of World War II. They were both born the year after the war. But I think as I get older, I understand more about how incredibly traumatic World War II was across the whole world, and particularly in Europe. There's so much poverty. People didn't have food. And I think that our family's traumas, and all of our family's traumas, kind of get passed down in different ways. And sometimes I think those trauma stories are like the wallpaper of our lives. They're just there. And we don't quite know how they inform our foreground, if you like. Mm. But I think they do. They shape how we experience the world. I think for me, as a young child, my mother contracted Hodgkin's lymphoma when I was one. And so she underwent treatment for a couple of years and then went into remission, and it came back when I was about 9. But for me, I don't know how I knew about the Holocaust, but I did, all through those sort of pre-10. And I did have some sense there was something going on in the background with my mum too. As a young child, I think there was a lot of uncertainty in me that I wasn't quite aware of, and anxiety. But I was a bit interesting in that I'm an information seeker. And so I was this young girl who I read books all the time, and I just took all of the books off my parents' bookshelf and read them all. So I read Schindler's List, which was back then called Schindler's Ark, when I was probably about 8. I think I went right through all of their Holocaust books, and I didn't find it overwhelming, actually. I remember just feeling like I just needed information to give me a sense of certainty. And so I think that's been one of the ways that I've coped with lots of unknowns in life, is to go and find out everything I can. And I probably have a particular desire to always know what's below the surface.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I think I grew up wondering what people weren't talking about, what wasn't being said. And I think actually that's probably had a big influence on me, because I think it's really important that we're transparent with each other in the world. Not too transparent, but I think that we're sense-making machines. Our brains need things to make sense. We need the pieces of information so we can get the big picture. Because without understanding and things making sense, we feel inherently uncertain and unsure. And I think as a psychologist, I feel like, and even as a parent, that it's really helpful to talk about stuff rather than not talk about it. When we talk about stuff, we're able to help each other understand and ask each other questions and have the world make some sense. And so as a parent, I probably have talked about a lot with my young man, who's not so young now. But
how old is your son?
My son's now 18. But I think it's about keeping things age appropriate and saying it in a way that is accessible and okay to that person. So for me, having open, honest relationships and conversations is perhaps one of the ways it's influenced me.
Yeah, that open dialogue is, I feel like it's crucial to navigating ourselves, but also, as you said before, like in relationship with anybody, whether that be a friend or your partner or your husband or wife or your sister or your mum, you know. And I think Esther Perel talks about this. She says that the quality of our relationships determine the quality of our lives.
Absolutely.
And I feel like that's similar to what you're talking about with the whole notion of what cat is and the relationship that's kind of built to in creating that safe space of understanding and kind of debunking the challenges that can arise in our lives.
Yeah. I guess Kat thinks about how we relate to others and how we relate to ourselves. And Kat talks about that in terms of patterns of relating. So, for example, if I have a kind of closed relationship where we don't talk about things, maybe we might talk about that as a pattern of maybe pretending or disconnecting, leaving others feeling disconnected or unsure, perhaps. And I think what you're talking about, Susie, is having patterns of relating with each other that are open. I think when we are able to be open and non-judging and understanding in the way we relate to each other and the messaging we give others about, that's the position we're happy wanting to take with them. We're wanting to be open and non-judging and understanding. Then people are able to open up to us and we can seek clarity and have that transparency in our relationships so that we all feel a bit more certain with each other.
Which reduces anxiety, doesn't it? For many people, not sitting in uncertainty is a pretty lovely thing.
Yeah. But we're not good at talking about hard stuff as people. We avoid it often, well, don't we?
To be honest, that's exactly the reason why I created this podcast is because these are the things that we need to talk about. We need to get better. Or we need to start educating ourselves because we didn't learn this at school. Yeah. So how do we start having those conversations and know that we're not alone in this journey and that there are people out there in life who are paving ways through that, through their professions, but also navigating the challenges themselves. It's what it is to be human.
Right? Yeah, I agree, Susie. And I think that as a relational therapist, which means a therapist who, you know, I work with this interpersonal therapy cat all day long, the complexity of relating and relationships is so obvious to me. And it is really complex and it is challenging to navigate for all of us. But the more we learn tools or skills, interpersonal skills, and often we don't just know them, like we have to practice stuff. Like I've spent many times in a mirror practicing an assertive thing, like how shall I say that? I'll say it like this, don't say that, say this, try this. When we practice something like assertiveness, there's an art to it. We need to practice and practice. Mm-hmm. And these kind of skills, I think, can help us negotiate or renegotiate some of our relationships. Or maybe there's sometimes it's that having that confidence to ask someone a question that makes you feel anxious and working out what's a way to ask it that has the other person feel safe. So our interpersonal world is really complex and we do want to get better at it. We want to practice. We want to have tools that help us navigate it so we don't just stay stuck interpersonally.
I think you raise a really good point, Helen, that we're not born with these skills. It's something that we need to actively work on. When we look at adolescents and kids who are growing up these days, it always feels like they have this weight of expecting themselves to already know the answer before they get to it. I don't know if you have some thoughts around that.
Do you mean in a way they're almost unrealistic expectations of what they should know and the handle they should have on life?
That I guess what you were just saying is that it does involve anxiety, a level of trepidation when we go through things for the first time. And that's really normal. And the more that we're able to talk about that and normalize it, the better, because it's actually not normal to not feel those emotions.
That's right. In my 20s, I was thinking, oh, haven't you got this sorted out yet? And then in my 30s, I thought, oh, you still haven't got it all sorted out? And now in my 50s, I'm like, oh, yeah, it takes a lifetime. That's right. This is what our journey is about. It's about having a go, falling on our face, getting back up, brushing ourselves off, trying something different, or even doing the same thing and falling on our face again. This is our journey of life. And maybe what you're saying about young people is we're not giving them that messaging that the beauty of being alive is being allowed to play and explore and fall over and have a laugh at yourself and go and chat to someone and see if they can help you find something out. And I think that's perhaps maybe what we refer to as having more realistic expectations about life. But I agree, I'm not sure that we're messaging that stuff very well at all.
Maybe part of that is modeling too. That's why, yeah, I really value the conversations on this podcast, because people are so open with their vulnerability in this space. Oh. And I think that's so important for us all to understand. We all get it wrong sometimes.
Absolutely.
And I totally identify with what you just said about having the pressure in your 20s and then by the 30s, thinking, why haven't I got this sorted out yet? And then realizing that, hang on, this is actually a journey that's going to be forever here as long as we're going to be here, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think our vulnerability is where so much of our joy lives and our beauty. And maybe we need to have conversations in our sort of broader culture about it being okay to be vulnerable and it being okay to not be okay and to not know.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think the topic of trauma is really interesting, and I'm interested to hear more of your view on how does unresolved trauma impact a person?
Oh, so huge question. And it's a huge question because the whole concept of trauma itself is a really complex phenomenon, I guess. And we could do lots of podcasts and people could do lots of research on just trauma, but I might just try and bring it down to more maybe a simple description. If we think about a traumatic experience as one that is perhaps overwhelming, or at the time that it's happening to us, we might experience really intense distress, like terror or fear or disgust or something like that. And so then when something happens later in our lives that reminds us or looks like that past experience, our brain switches on and goes, that thing's happening again. Switches on our whole fight or flight system, if you like, and sometimes even brings back some of those feelings. So we almost re-experience it as if it's happening again. I might use an example to help make a bit more sense. Let's say we've got this boy called Johnny who's in maths class and his teacher has him stand up in class and says something that is absolutely humiliating and he feels humiliated in front of everybody. So Johnny would, after that class, he might, every time he walks down the corridor and sees his teacher or knows that he's got maths on for that day, he might start feeling those feelings again and start feeling really anxious. So Johnny's going to start probably school refusing down the track or refusing to go to maths or something like that. And so I guess in a way his trauma isn't resolved, meaning it replays. Or he anticipates situations that are going to be like that one that happened at school. And Johnny might, so he might just re-experience intense feelings in sort of situations, or he might even feel like it's happening again to him in other classes, but it's actually not happening. And Johnny might even take some ways of protecting or defending himself against that happening again. So he might even become a bully, making sure he gets in first. So unresolved trauma can present in so many different ways. I think we're all different in the way that it comes out in us. But I'd like to say, Susie, I think life is not smooth sailing from the time we're born right through. You know, we fall over, we break limbs. People say mean things to us. People love us, they leave us. Trauma is a part of life. And I think most of us have unresolved traumas. Most of us get anxious about things. And I think the message too is, you know, we're not meant to be perfect. We don't have to have it all fixed. It's okay to be not okay. We have good therapy. We have good treatments for trauma. People can talk to their friends or come and see psychologists or any therapist. Doesn't need to be a psychologist.
Thanks for the example, because I think that really helps solidify in our minds how it can transpire for a person in that experience. We think about it in a school context, school refusal or becoming a bully. When we see those sorts of behaviours, to start asking the in-depth questions and understand the why behind it.
Yeah, that's right. Maybe it comes back to being able to have those open and transparent, understanding conversations with each other that helps us get underneath what's happened for someone or what's really bothering them.
So at age 16, you actually knew that you wanted to be a psychologist. It's quite remarkable that you had such certainty at that point. Where did that come from?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's one of the most, there's a few things I've been certain about in my life and a whole bunch I'm not, but I was certain about that. I think losing my mother and perhaps the Holocaust story had me deeply interested in human experience. I suppose I was a bit of a deep thinker. Maybe I would have been anyway, I'm not sure. I was definitely curious about psychology and as weirdly as reading Holocaust books, I read all of Freud's volumes when I was 16, which is not normal to
do. Oh, wow.
I don't know why, but I think I had this hunger to know. Maybe I've just had a fascination with how we work. But I think too, Susie, perhaps my yearning for that understanding was my way of coping with the uncertainty of my childhood, I think. Perhaps that's one of my solutions.
Decoding yeah. and kind of making sense of it, hey?
I think so.
Yeah, that makes a whole bunch of sense, really. And it's what many of us are trying to do.
To make sense.
To make sense of it.
You know, thinking about this theme of uncertainty, that just feels like such an important comment that actually we just need the world to make sense. First and foremost, it needs to make sense. How do we deal with something that doesn't make sense?
We ask our guests one very beautiful question at the end of our conversations, and I'd love to ask you that question. What are you feeling uncertain about at the moment, and how do you best support yourself?
Oh, perhaps depends on what day you ask me the question, Susie. I think that some of the uncertainties I have to do with my sort of stage of life, which unbeknown to me till now was going to be about health. And I hate to say it, but this is what we all talk about is our health. But definitely the uncertainty of the people that I care about getting illnesses. There's so much cancer and things around and people die. People are dying. Like no one told me after a certain age we were going to be faced with more of that. And that stuff's really hard. I feel a bit uncertain about what the future holds for our young people, like my young man. But I've also noticed there's been a sort of sense of being ramped up, I think, in the last maybe post-COVID. And I can't quite put my finger on it, but I think it's just the constant changing of everything. There's the economic news changes constantly. I had been really concerned about climate change. I felt slightly better when I read some helpful data a couple of weeks ago. I was like, oh, will we get this? I feel really uncertain about the way we do politics around the world. I feel uncertain about the way we dialogue with each other, the sort of tendency for polarization rather than us having these open, understanding, non-judging dialogues where we really hear each other and are able to find more complex solutions to some of the problems that we deal with. So that's the sort of broad stuff that I think sits in the background, but it matters. It's part of the soup that we're all living in.
Great word.
But the way I try and manage or deal with that is maybe it's about what we were talking about before, about tuning into what, having a think about what it is that I really need, but internally what I need. I think sometimes when we talk about self-care and looking after ourselves, sometimes I think we still think about that a little bit externally. Looking after ourselves is having a deep think about what does our body need right now? Do I need to just sit in a space and stare at the trees for an hour? So making room, making space for myself and my needs in the world, I think that's a really helpful thing for all of us to do.
Beautiful, Helen. If you're curious about cognitive analytic therapy, you can find out more at the Australian and New Zealand Association for Cognitive Analytical Therapy at anzacat.org.au. If you found this episode helpful, keep an eye out for Helen's new parenting and wellbeing workshops called We Need to Talk. I know I'm excited to learn more. Helen, thank you so much for being here with us today on the Let's Check In podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Susie. I really enjoyed talking to you. Thanks.
Thanks for checking in with me today. So you never miss an episode, hit follow or subscribe wherever you listen. If today's episode resonated, share it with someone who's navigating their own wobbly season. Find and follow us across Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, and LinkedIn at Let's Check In Podcast. This podcast is not a licensed mental health service, and it is not a substitute for professional mental health advice. If something has come up for you in this episode, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14.